Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller, who's enjoying a day off. And we're glad to have you along with us today, talking about science and research with Bassam Shakashiri, UW Madison Professor of Chemistry and the William T. Evue Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA and Director of the Initiative for Science Literacy. Bassam, it's a pleasure to have you back in our studio.
Happy to be with you, Jim, especially on this
especially on this first day of spring. Couldn't come along at a better time after a long, long winter.
Happy spring to you, to everyone also in the listening audience. And yes, we need it, and despite the forecast for our area tonight and tomorrow, but maybe they'll be wrong about that. Springtime, yes. This is actually a time when a lot of people look forward to more daylight.
Mm-hmm.
It's the vernal equinox, which means equal what? Daylight hours as night hours. And along with this are some myths. Some people, for recreational purposes, I hope they don't take it seriously, they say you can take an egg and on the first day of spring and have it sit straight up. And
well, you brought some eggs.
We have a carton of eggs here. Do you want to grab one and see if you can do it?
I'm going to see if I can do it.
Okay.
So the object is to be able to stand this egg on its end and have it stand straight up. Without my fingers holding it. But I'm trying to, find that point at which it's going to stand. It's almost there, but it doesn't seem to want to stand on
it. It's a myth. And as I say, it's good recreation as long as people don't take it seriously. And I think it's really important to be thinking about science literacy and look at debunking myths through experimentation. People might want to try this, and if they do, they're well, good luck in having them succeed in having the eggs stand up.
There's also a myth that has something to do with that you're able to spin an egg.
Yeah, actually, now, as you say, we have this carton of eggs here, and you know how you can tell the difference between a raw egg and a hard-boiled egg, Jim?
How is that?
Well, it has to do with the spin that you just mentioned. So why don't you try to spin that egg that you have.
All right, I'm going to try to see if I can spin this egg.
Just spin it,
it doesn't really.
It doesn't spin. It has fluid in it.
Yes.
It has not coagulated yet because it hasn't been cooked. How about grabbing the one of the other eggs that I have there? See if you can spin that one.
All right. So I'm grabbing the egg and I'm spinning it, and sure enough.
And that's the hard-boiled egg.
So
the coagulation has taken place, and that's an easy way to tell the difference between a hard-boiled egg and a raw egg. And just to be sure that you are convinced of this, why don't you take the one that you think is a raw egg and crack it in this dish that I have here?
Yes, it is.
It is the raw.
It is indeed a raw egg.
And how about the next one? The other one?
Oh, it came down and it's a hard-boiled egg.
All right.
If I had salt and pepper, I would I'd devour it. But
keep the salt down a little bit, you know. So
with just a tiny bit of salt.
Tiny bit of salt will
and
be
a lot
right,
of pepper.
Right.
Just
right.
to add to the taste.
Right.
So that is an example that shows that that the fluid in the uncooked egg prevents it from being able to spin.
That's right.
And that because the egg has been cooked, then it is hard enough and stable enough so that it is able to spin.
Right. The viscosity of the liquid in the raw egg prevents it from spinning as does the hard-boiled egg. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the explanation, right.
So if people would like to join this conversation about the equinox or the other topics that we'll be talking about today, then all you have to do is give us a call in Madison at 263-1890 or toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. Of course, that's a toll-free call. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. The price of crude. Yes, Bassam.
I was just going to say about the equinox.
Yes.
About 20 years ago or so, a study was done with Harvard University graduates and faculty, and they were asked to explain the reason as to why we have four seasons. And 21 out of 23 people interviewed could not give a correct explanation for why we have four seasons. There are misconceptions that we all have, you know, about phenomena that are very familiar to us, but we should really try to improve our understanding and our explanations of what's going on. So this is the 20th anniversary of this study, and I'm happy to say that although I don't have the exact data here, but by and large, more people are able to explain now than they did before why we have four seasons. And this is a question I usually pose to the audience when I come on this program, especially on an equinox day or even a summer solstice day.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, why is it that we have four seasons? And one of the important misconceptions is that people say, well, we are getting closer to the sun, and that's why we feel warmer. And in the summertime, we feel even warmer. That's a misconception, actually. And I'm so pleased to see that the level of science literacy has changed. But we have to be vigilant about this to make sure that the young people also think about these questions and are able to provide reasonable explanations and to deal with misconceptions properly. It is somewhat intuitive to us. If we're closer to a hot stove, you know, we feel warmer.
Mm-hmm.
But we really have to think about what's going on celestially. And so, of course, everyone, I hope, knows the explanation that it's the tilt of the Earth as it goes around its axis that is responsible for having the four seasons. And as we today in the Northern Hemisphere celebrate the arrival of spring, of course, people in the Southern Hemisphere are celebrating the arrival of
fall.
Exactly.
So it would be the opposite of what we've got. They get down there.
Right, right.
But don't get it to the extent that we get it.
No, it's to the same extent. It'll be fall and then come winter for them as we go from spring to summer. And as the Earth goes around its axis, then it tilts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another interesting question. Why is there a tilt? What caused the tilt? What causes the tilt? Why? So all of these questions for commonly known phenomena are worthy of taking a look at. And they make good conversations, not only around the dinner table at home, but in the office, everywhere. And the important point is to really be reasonable and try to enjoy the different explanations that are offered.
All right. Well, let's talk about that with our listeners. And our first caller is going to be Frank in New Glarus. And Frank, what's on your mind today?
Yes, you were talking about standing an egg on end.
Yes.
This can be done today since we're on daylight savings time, it would be 1 o'clock instead of noon, and I have done it many, many, many times. It is not just a myth.
And what did you actually do, Frank?
You can balance the egg on end at 1 o'clock, which would be a normal noon. It will stand there on end.
Now,
if
spring arrived at 12 something this morning, why is it able then to stand on end at noon 12 hours later?
No, I didn't say 12 hours later. I said at noon today.
Yeah, but spring arrived officially
12:58
at 12:58 this morning. So why would it be that your experiment would hold up 12 hours later?
Well, it does.
It does. All right. Well,
that's a good answer.
Believe me, it does.
All right. We'll take your word. We'll take your word.
That's a good answer, Frank. We have to do experiments and try to explain what we observe and try to make sense out of these explanations. And so if people are going to try at 1 p.m., Central Daylight Time today to put an egg to try to have an egg stand straight up, by all means, try it. But as I say, it is a good recreational activity, and it's a cause for us to think about the arrival of spring and the change in the four seasons.
Frank, thank you very much. We appreciate that. And Fran and Nina, what's on your mind?
Well, I had always heard that it was at the equator. that the egg would stand on end. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I happened to be in Peru on March 21st or 20th at the equator. And we did. They had a little monument there. And we all tried standing the egg on end. And with a little careful balancing, and it did stand on end. And I have a picture taken of me and then another one of my friends that I was with this egg that was standing on end at the equator on March, on the first day of spring.
The internet, Fran, is full of such pictures with many eggs allegedly standing up, not only at the equator but elsewhere, as Frank was saying before. And so you really have to think about what it is that can be a plausible or a reasonable explanation for this phenomenon that you say you have pictures of. And
sure.
And so, I mean, there's nothing really that's going on that gives us an explanation as to why this happens at this particular time. Have you tried it any other time of the year?
No, I should try it, though. I'll try it at 1 o'clock this afternoon.
Well, try it try it today, and then you can try it some other days, too.
Sure.
And, you know, try it on June 1st. Pick a day and see if that happens. And thank you.
And when they conduct their experiments, they should report to you, and how would they reach you?
Well, they can always get to us through the Science is Fun website, which is www.scifun.org.
Well, I always enjoy when you're on the program, glad to take my call.
Fran, thank you so much. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, and the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Let's go next to Tom in Madison. And Tom, what's on your mind?
Well, I have one more spin on spinning eggs.
All right.
When you guys were spinning the egg, you were trying to spin it vertically. If you lay the egg down and spin it and then try to stop it and remove your hand quickly, the egg will want to continue to spin because the egg, the liquid in the egg still has energy stored up in it and will want it to keep rotating.
That's true, but the hard-boiled egg spins better than the raw egg.
Absolutely, but I just thought I'd put at least one more spin.
All right. Thanks for that spin on that, Tom. Our guest, again, Bassam Shakashiri, as we continue talking about the equinox. And another call on that is from Corey in Watertown. Hello, Corey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty well.
I'm another one with an egg story. I also have been for many years. I'm a grandfather now and plan to do it today with my grandchildren. That I have tried on different days of the year to stand an egg on end. And I have been able and successful every year to do it on the equinox. And I am just surprised that it's referred to as a myth when I'm able to accomplish it on that day only. I've also tried on the other equinox, whatever, I can't remember what it's called, but it doesn't do it on that day. And I don't know if it's just I'm having incredible luck over the past 30 years or that there is some validity to the test I'm doing.
This is the reason that I brought this up in the first place, so that people do experiments and think about the experiments and try to come up with reasonable explanations for them. So the myth is that you can do this only on the vernal equinox. In the northern hemisphere. I wonder if people in the southern hemisphere can do it when they have their vernal equinox 6 months from now. So to me, this is, as I say, a recreational activity that makes us all think about different phenomena and different beliefs that we have and try to either validate the observations that we make and see if they make sense, but also think about other people's explanations and what it is that is that's really going on. So I'm all for experimentations. In fact, on my website, there's a whole slew of experiments you can download and do them at home. And all you have to do is go to our scifun.org webpage and write up front, you'll see that experiments you can do at home. This is not one of them, but we just talked enough about this one now so people can try it.
Corey, thanks a lot.
Okay.
appreciate hearing from you. Again, our guest is Bassam Shakashuri, who is the director of the Initiative for Science Literacy and the William T. Evue Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the IDEA's Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the IDEA's Network. Glad to have you along with us today. We have a couple lines open. If you have a call in Madison, the number is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. We'll go to the calls in a second. Price of crude oil jumped over $100 a barrel a few weeks ago. But Sam, what is the effect on the petrochemical industry? Because a lot of our common materials, plastics, PVC and such, are made from petroleum products.
Indeed, this is going to have a big effect. Even though these plastics are relatively cheap, you know, they're very inexpensive. And they are inexpensive because they are products of the petrochemical industry. Crude oil now has hit over $100. It wasn't all that long ago that it was about $50 or $60. And so this is going to have a serious effect on our economy, our usage of products that are made not only, as you say, PVC, polyvinyl chloride, polyethylene, polypropylene, all kinds of plastic material. They're going to go up in price, and so people now are in the industry and the government are concerned about this, not only in terms of what we pay at the gasoline pump, but the other consequences of the petrochemical products. And so that's why it is an important point to think about and to consider looking at alternatives. And as we look at alternatives, we have to be careful in what we select. Right now, coal, common coal, is becoming attractive as a source of feedstock that leads into petrochemical products, what we call now petrochemical, you know, the plastics and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really very important to keep in mind that coal mining is still going on. It is a dangerous operation. There are economies around the world that are dependent on power, generation of power through coal-fired plants. And there are serious pollution issues related to that. Not only the danger in mining the coal, but also in what happens after you burn the coal. So you're going to generate more carbon dioxide gas, and that's going to contribute to the increase in the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and this is going to adversely contribute to global warming. So there are all kinds of issues that relate to this. But now some people in industry are finding the use of coal as a good thing to, economically, a good thing to do through a process called gasification. Gasification is a process where you take coal and in a closed environment, you pump steam into it and oxygen. And this converts it into a mixture of gases, including carbon monoxide, hydrogen gas, some hydrogen sulfide, and so on. Depends what else is in the coal.
Mm-hmm.
And this mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen is called synthesis gas. You'll read about it in the newspaper as syngas, S-Y-N.
S-Y-N.
It's not the other syn. And the synthesis gas can be converted through catalytic processes industrially, been known for a long time, to useful products, including methanol, including ammonia, because the hydrogen that's generated from this process can be then removed and combined with nitrogen through a catalytic process to give us ammonia, which is then very useful for fertilizers and all kinds of other applications. And the cost for this gasification process is a lot less than it would be to secure the feedstock for the petrochemical products. And as long as the price of crude oil is above $50 to $60, as it is now twice that, major industries around the world are thinking and rushing into pursuing these gasification processes. Again, as I say, the science has been well known for decades and been used, but there are issues associated with it. The issues primarily are pollution issues, and there are issues that affect the economic growth in other countries like China. In China, they're building a coal-fired plant every week. They're building 50 plants were built last year to burn coal to produce energy because we need it for electric power and other sources of energy that we enjoy very, very much nowadays. So this is a well-known process, and we just have to exercise good judgment not to quickly substitute, try to meet our needs by substituting a potentially dirty process without being concerned about its consequences.
All right, let's go back to the phones and to Megan, who I think has been waiting longest in Canton, Minnesota. Hello, Megan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about sustainable energy. My husband and I run a sustainable energy research farm. We basically, it's woody agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So crops off of trees, and some of the crops can be used for energy because the trees produce more than one crop. And we've just been having a horrible time with people backing away from sustainable energy because of the rise in food prices due to ethanol. You know, and the fact that nobody really understands that ethanol is a losing proposition because it actually is not more efficient than gas. It actually costs more. But because there are so many farmers needing...
So did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if there was a way, you know, how we can get more information out about other sustainable crops.
I'm surprised that you weren't listening yesterday because we devoted a program. We devoted a program,
no.
And we do that every month.
Oh, no. No, I was taking my
biofuels. Okay, well, we do a program every month now on biofuels. One was yesterday, so about a month from now we'll be doing another.
Okay.
The Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is now located at the University of Wisconsin.
Okay.
And so there'll be lots of information coming up about that.
Excellent.
So it's not really appropriate that we continue this topic since we just talked about it in great discussion yesterday, but we do appreciate you bringing it up. To Black River Falls and to Greg. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Actually, I have three very short questions, but after hearing the last caller, I might have to change one of them. My first question is, what about eggs that have two yolks? Do they respond the same way after they've been boiled?
Yes, once the eggs, egg coagulates, yes, it does, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was sort of a fun question. But my second question is, I'm new to the area. I moved here from the deep south, and so snow is pretty new to me. Does snow, after it's fallen, does it evaporate more from the top than it does melt on the bottom?
That's a very good observation that you have made. And snow and ice undergo a process called sublimation. That's when a solid changes directly from being a solid into a gas without melting. And this year in Wisconsin and elsewhere in our region here, many of us, all of us, probably noticed that the level of the snowbank has gone down,
mm-hmm.
even though the temperature was below freezing. And you know, Jim, it's been below freezing for a long time earlier. And that's because of this sublimation process that takes place. If you think about, are you familiar with the frost-free refrigerator?
Yes, I am.
That's how it works.
Okay.
The frost that's in the refrigerator is removed through the sublimation process by passing a stream of air through it, and that aids the sublimation process. A lot of substances, common substances, have this property, including mothballs. You know, these air fresheners that we hang from the rearview mirror in the car, or sometimes you plug them into the wall at home, they have in them solids that change directly to a gas through the sublimation process.
Okay, thank you. My third question, though, has a little bit to do with bioenergy, but it's a direct question. So I'm familiar with the acetone butanol fermentation, which is an anaerobic fermentation to produce acetone butanol from corn matter. And in the United States, it was used during World War One and right up to the end of 1947, I believe. But isn't acetone butanol, doesn't it have a higher heat content on a per mole basis than alcohol does? So why do we persist in ethanol production? That's the first part of the question. Second part of the question is, won't we destroy soil fertility if we go to using any
crop that's planted on arable ground?
Very good questions, Greg. And as Jim mentioned earlier, yesterday's program covered all this. And in fact, listeners, if you have access to the internet, you can go to the Wisconsin Public Radio website and listen to yesterday's program, just as you can listen to all the programs that are broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. And I think that issue was addressed yesterday.
Yes, it was. And do appreciate the call, and you'll find the answers there specifically, Greg. So we thank you so much for that. David, let's go to you in Waukesha next. Hello, David.
Yes, good afternoon. I have more of a physics question. As we all know, the moon orbits the Earth, and it rotates the same side as facing the Earth. Now, it seems to me highly unlikely that this precise synchronization should just be chance. Yet I scratch my head for an explanation of what forces, past or present, could be responsible for this synchronization.
That's a good question, too. Do you know how the moon was formed in the first place?
My understanding is that quite possibly it might have been a collision with the Earth, and a large portion was pulled away.
That's one of the And so the exact synchronization, as you describe it, I mean that's a naturally occurring phenomenon, and. Why is it that way? That's what you're asking, right?
Yes.
Why is it that way, Jim? I have to think about that as to, you know, you're asking why something is the way it is. What's the explanation? I have to think about that and try to give you a coherent response. In fact, as Jim mentioned, you know, we do post the summary of this discussion on my website, and I'll make sure I put that, David, in the next couple of days. I know how to find out the answer to that one.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. So scifund.org, in a couple of days, we'll have an exact answer for you. Thanks very much for your question. Audrey in River Falls, let's go there. Hi, Audrey.
Hi. I heat up oil to fry fish in, and I have a thermometer in it, and it goes up to 250, and I can stir it so it's mixed. You know, there's no hot layer on the bottom. And it's 250, and then I put a piece of breaded fish in it, and the temperature immediately goes up to 350, and that has really got me baffled.
When you put the fish in the
hot oil,
in the hot oil,
it goes. The temperature goes right up to 350.
And where is your thermometer?
In the oil.
It's still in the same location.
Yeah.
It isn't that it's touching the bottom of the pan or anything like that.
No, it isn't touching the bottom of the pan. And as I said, I stir the oil well before I put the fish in so that, you know, there isn't a layer of hotter oil at the bottom of the pan where the heat is coming from.
I just wonder if the oil is uniformly mixed to begin with. It goes up by 100 degrees?
100 degrees. I just can't figure it out.
What's the highest reading that your thermometer can
Oh, I think it probably goes up to 500 or something, with, of course, a lot of lit red warning things.
Yeah, be careful about that. What is the thermometer made of? What's the fluid in the thermometer?
I don't know. It's just...
What color is it?
You can't see any color. It's a metal...
Oh, it's a temperature probe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's surprising to me. I don't know how to explain that. This happens repeatedly, you say?
Yeah. We've been testing it, and we used to think, well, get it up to 350 because that's a good temperature to fry at.
When you put the fish in, what temperature is the fish at?
Pretty close to room temperature by that time.
Yeah.
So, I'm afraid that you've baffled Bassam.
You got me. The temperature goes up.
I've been asking everybody learned and just waiting until I could ask you.
What did they ask? What kinds of responses have you gotten?
They don't know either.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to have to experiment with this to see, because that's a drastic change. When the temperature is going up, there's got to be a source of heat that makes it go up that rapidly immediately.
Yeah, I can imagine steam. Steam under pressure can get a lot hotter, but there's no pressure here.
Well, and then the fish is at room temperature. There's no steam in it. So,
well, you're going to have an answer on the website.
Well, definitely.
At scifund.org. And in this case, I'm sure that the next time you come back, you'll bring an answer along.
I'd be happy to.
All right, Audrey. Thanks very much for baffling the professor. On to Vern in Appleton. Hi, Vern.
Hello. I have a question that has bothered me for a long time. On a turning shaft of solid metal, now the outside of the shaft are going to be turning in different directions. If dead center, is there something that isn't turning? Can you understand what I'm getting at?
Not really. How is that the outside is turning in different directions?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, for instance, if you have a solid metal shaft and it's turning to the right.
So let's say it's turning clockwise.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, the right-hand side would be going down while the left-hand side would be coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the way they're is what I'm saying. They're going in different directions. Dead center, is there something that isn't moving?
Well, if the shaft is going down, there's something that's pushing something else up, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but if it's just turning, you know, just a simple shaft of solid material.
And it's moving.
Yeah, it's turning.
It's turning, yeah. I mean, it's being used as a shaft, right?
Right.
Yeah, you're drilling something going...
Right.
Yeah.
And so the outside, like I said, the right-hand side would be going down. The left-hand side would be coming up. And they're going in, therefore, opposite directions is the way I would see it.
Well, what's going up?
The side of the shaft, the... what do you call the outside?
If you're cranking it and going clockwise and it's going down, then what's coming up?
The opposite side of that shaft.
As you're looking at it from the top, or
no, from the end. If you're looking at it from the end, I'm thinking of the shaft as being horizontal.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's turning, no matter how fast.
Yeah.
The is it the circumference of the outside there? The edge of the shaft. One side would be going down while the other side would be turning, coming up.
I'm going to have to consult with my colleague in mechanical engineering about this to make sure I understand what you're describing first before I attempt to...
Your question is that at the center of that shaft, is it not moving at all?
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean... I can't, in my mind, conceive of something, two things going in different directions. It'd have to come down to molecules, I'm sure. But as the shaft goes around the end, and I'm visualizing, looking at it from the end,
mm-hmm.
the right-hand side would be, if it's going clockwise, would be going in a downward motion, while the left-hand side would be coming in an upward motion.
Maybe someone in our listening audience can call in.
Well, there's only a few minutes left, so you're going to have to consult with your friend.
I'm going to consult with that, yeah, right.
And again, go to scifund.org for that to find out whether or not at the center of the shaft that there is no movement at all and everything is moving around that point. These are interesting questions.
Very interesting questions.
A very learned audience, I would say. Gino, let's go to you next. Hello, Gino.
Hello. I know that UWM is doing some experimentation with their power plant to try to get the pollution down. Are they using an LG filter at all on that?
I'm not familiar with the specific project you're talking about. There are lots of attempts by UWM and other UW institutions, in fact, across the state to lower pollution. I don't know specifically which one you're talking about, Gino.
Yeah, because a few years ago on PBS and Channel 10, they had a program with Alan Alda, and he was at a power plant where they used the exhaust from a coal-burning plant. They ran it through a water filter with algae in it, and that took out all the pollution, and then they were able to turn the algae from that filter into biodiesel.
That's possible, yes.
But
we don't know the specifics about the power plants that you're referring to.
UWM's not doing that right now.
I don't know for sure. They may be. They may be.
It is possible.
Yeah.
All right. I was just interested in that. All
right. Thanks a lot. You know what? We do have an answer about the shaft question, and that's Pete and Joliet. Hello, Pete.
Hi. How you doing?
We're doing well, if you've got the right answer for us.
Well, I think what the gentleman's referring to is that if you took a shaft that's rotating, and if you cut it in half at the end, or if you look at the end of it, you know, of course, it's always rotating in one direction, clockwise or counterclockwise.
Right.
And what he's saying is, if you look at just the end, the perimeter, say a vector at the very outside diameter, on the right side, say at the 3 o'clock position, it's going down. The vector is going down. And then if you look at the 9 o'clock position, the opposite side, the rotation is going up. So he's calling that opposite.
Right.
And then his question is, if you go right to the center of it, the atoms right at the middle of the shaft, the center of rotation, you know, the center of mass is the center of rotation, what happens with the molecule right dead center?
And the answer?
Saying, he's saying, is that spinning as well? And the answer is, yeah, it is, because it's got to be rotating. It's just that it's a point, and it rotates around the same rotation as the perimeter. It's just that the distance it moves and the speed it travels is really, really small.
In relation to the outside of the shaft.
Exactly. Just as you go toward the center, the rotational speed just drops off to a very small amount.
I'll double-check on that.
Pete, thanks a lot.
Okay.
You've given another wrinkle to Bassam's forehead, I think. We've got questions that we didn't get to, and obviously we'll take those up when we see you again. Thanks for coming in, and you've got a lot of work ahead of you there, Professor.
I'm always happy to do this kind of work and to share whatever we come up with our audience. Thank you, Jim.
I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of the questions. Our guest has been Bassam Shakashuri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, and the William T. Evue Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA, Director of the Initiative for Science Literacy. And if you'd like a CD of the program, it's available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Of course, you can always hear Larry Mueller's programs by going to WPR.org and click on Larry Mueller's button. And there you will be able to listen to programs for the last 3 years, I believe, or at least they're up there for a three-year period. So yesterday's program, today's program, whatever you'd like, it'll be there. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks very much to Carmen Jackson for on-air phone production. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.